Sure. Maybe tomorrow we wake up and everyone realizes, well, that was crazy. Let's all calm down. Do you really think that's what's going to happen?
People are going to people. Most people are going to go through public school and then higher education, and they're never going to think twice about it. They're never going to reflect on what it did to them, the programs that it installed in their behavior and their thinking. Most people are not going to be your target market. But some people are going to have something that goes off, and they're going to start looking, and they're going to start trying to figure out what a solution is. They're going to start trying to figure out what a better way for their own children might be. And then you're going to be there. And it's not your job to tell people, hey, this is how school should be. It's to find the people who recognize the problem with the education system and want something better. And then you provide them solutions. And for me, that's social media and using it to market. Yes, I see tribalism and division and echo chambers being a problem that lead to bigger problems, that lead to some of the situations that we're in socially right now. But it's not my job to go out and tell everybody, hey, this is the problem with social media. It's my job to find the people that recognize social media can be used differently than the way 99% of people are using it. And it's my job to help those people and show them paths to a better use of social media. There's the consumer mindset and there's the producer mindset. There's us and there's them.
Told myself, you gotta freak that guy, the one inside who'll never beat that knot. The lies, fake bros, they won't shine. I realize ain't no leisure time. I came to conquer, break down. I'm so bright, had to leave up behind. I'm too ahead, kiss my fit behind. Run this sprinting through your mind like.
Please welcome to the stage, Alexander Nix, Chief Executive Officer, Cambridge Analytica.
Ladies and gentlemen, honorable colleagues, it's my privilege to speak to you today about the power of big data and psychographics in the electoral process, and specifically to talk about the work that we contributed to Senator Cruz's presidential primary campaign. It's easy to forget that only 18 months ago, Senator Cruz was one of the less popular candidates seeking nomination, and certainly one of the more vilified. In addition to which, he had very low name recognition. Only about 40% of the electorate had heard of him, as compared to Jeb Bush up in the mid-80s. And he was competing in one of the most competitive primary fields ever in Republican politics. Additionally, he was seeking to make his voice heard to a largely homogeneous audience. Yet come May 2016, Senator Cruz was the only serious contender, the only credible threat to the phenomenon Donald Trump. So how did he do this? The Cruz campaign was quick to embrace three technologies, three methodologies that propelled them to success. The first of these was behavioral science. Probably the easiest way to explain this is through example. Were you lucky enough to own a private beach and you wanted to stop people from using it, you might put up the sign on the left here. This is largely informational and seeks to inform attitudes. Conversely, you could use the communication on the right. This is behavioral communication, and it seeks to probe an altogether much more powerful underlying motivation. Clearly, the threat of being eaten by a shark might prevent you from swimming in their sea. Yet, this is complex to do, and as a consequence, most communication companies today still segment their audiences by demographics and geographics. But when you pause for just a moment, this is a really ridiculous idea. The idea that all women should receive the same message because of their gender, or all African Americans because of their race, or all old people, or rich people, or young people to get the same message because of their demographics just doesn't make any sense. Clearly, demographics and geographics and economics will influence your worldview. But equally important, or probably more important, are psychographics. That is an understanding of your personality, because it's personality that drives behavior, and behavior that obviously influences how you vote. So how is this possible? Well, at Cambridge, we've rolled out a long-form quantitative instrument to probe the underlying traits that inform personality. This is the cutting edge in experimental psychology known as the OCEAN model. OCEAN being an acronym for openness, how open you are to new experiences. Conscientiousness, whether you prefer order and habits and planning in your life. Extroversion, how social you are. Agreeableness, whether you put other people's needs and society and community ahead of yourself. And finally, neuroticism, a measurement of how much you tend to worry. By having hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Americans undertake this survey, we were able to form a model to predict the personality of every single adult in the United States of America. So how does this impact marketing and communications in elections? For a primary, the Second Amendment might be a popular issue amongst the electorate. If you know the personality of the people you're targeting, you can nuance your messaging to resonate more effectively with those key audience groups. So, for a highly neurotic and conscientious audience, you're going to need a message that is rational and fear-based or emotionally based. In this case, the threat of a burglary and the insurance policy of a gun is very persuasive. Conversely, for a closed and agreeable audience, these are people who care about tradition and habits and family and community. This could be the grandfather who taught his son to shoot and the father who will in turn teach his son. Obviously, talking about these values is going to be much more effective in communicating your message. The second leg of the stool, data analytics. Communication is fundamentally changing. Back in the days of Mad Men, communication was essentially top-down. That is, it's creative-led. Brilliant minds get together and come up with slogans like Beans Means Heinz and Coca-Cola is it, and they push these messages onto the audience in the hope that they resonate. Today, we don't need to guess at what creative solution may or may not work. We can use hundreds or thousands of individual data points on our target audiences to understand exactly which messages are going to appeal to which audiences way before the creative process starts. So what is big data? Big data is really the aggregation of as many individual data points that you can possibly get your hands on, which are then synthesized in one database of record, cleaned or hygiened, and then used to inform and create insight on your target audience. This could include demographic and geographic factors, age, gender, ethnicity, religion, and so forth. Or psychographic or attitudinal factors. This is consumer and lifestyle habits, what car you drive, what products you purchase in shops, what magazines you read, what golf clubs you belong to, what churches you attend. And of course, personality or behavioral data. This is what we talked about earlier, how you see the world, what actually drives you. The easiest way to illustrate big data in action is through a real-life example. This is a data dashboard that we prepared for the Cruz campaign for the Iowa caucus. But if we select some segments within this matrix, it becomes even more powerful. In this case, we've zoned in on a group we've called persuasion. These are people who are definitely going to vote, to caucus, but they need moving from the center a little bit more towards the right in order to support Cruz. They need a persuasion message. And we can look at this group of about 45,000 people, and we can see that the mean personality is very low in neuroticism, quite low in openness, and slightly conscientious. We can segment further. We can look at what issue they care about. Gun rights I've selected. That narrows the field slightly more. And now we know that we need a message on gun rights. It needs to be a persuasion message, and it needs to be nuanced according to the certain personality that we're interested in. And we can see where these people are on the map. If we wanted to drill down further, we could resolve the data to an individual level, where we have somewhere close to 4,000 or 5,000 data points on every adult in the United States.
Before I initiate your personalized AI, I need some information from you. How do you feel about your career?
Everything's cool, you know. I'm still on my grind. Nigga trying to get these checks, get paid.
Say no more. I've loaded you a new AI, Sam. She can guide you.
Hey, Sam.
Yes, sir.
How do I be the coolest motherfucker in the world?
Yeah. There ain't no data.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Thursday, January 7th. It's a little bit outrageous that I would be asking for some portion of your media consumption time on a day like this. But I promise the conversation you're about to hear, in addition to being great, it's part 5 in our Emotional Manipulators for Hire series. In addition to being great, it is certainly related in a very causal way to a lot of the things that we've been watching play out over the last 24 hours, the last several weeks, the last several months, all of 2020, the last 5 years. This show is useful well beyond all of these current events. Nathan and I actually recorded this last night while all of this news in DC was breaking. The topic is social media, which is many currents. People really don't know they're in, and they really don't know where those currents are taking them. But we are going to elaborate on that in the show you're about to hear. This is the 5th installment in our monthly series, Emotional Manipulators for Hire. Nathan and I discuss his strategies for social media shitposting for fun and profit. He has a course by the same name. In this so-called age of surveillance capitalism. There were many parts of this discussion where we didn't see eye to eye, and I actually thought that was great. We need more of that in these shows. If you're a new listener and you enjoyed today's show, please make sure you go back and check out all episodes in this series. You can just go to schoolsucksproject.com, click on this post, and there is a little category tag, Emotional Manipulators for Hire. Click that. You can see all the episodes. And in closing, of course, I just want to wish you well. Please be careful out there. Please be careful in front of your computer, too, for God's sake. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for your time. And I'll talk to you again soon. Take care.
I went on a drive with my window down on a highway, daydreaming, losing my mind. See my dead body.
There ain't no
women on where me and my friends are going on a deep web shit and stay exploring with a smartwatch wrist that never born. There's a lit up screen I ain't ignoring.
Wanna be fly, wanna be smooth, yeah.
When I got into your free Market Squad material, I noticed that you had a course on one of the things that I think you do best. I bill you in this series as the world champion of Facebook. I frequently repost the things you post on Facebook where I say nothing and just put a trophy and share whatever you post. But you know that's going to happen with the stuff you post because you have a great formula for shitposting on Facebook and doing actually a variety of types of posts on Facebook. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today. But in addition to just waiting for the show to hear like some of your methodology behind how you use Facebook to generate business, I also think, in keeping with the larger theme of this series, talking about how, you know, all of these things are double-edged swords. They can be used against us, and the better we understand them, we can employ tactics and techniques and principles in our own work for good, as I have said. And this might be, I think, and you might disagree, the best example of good versus evil that we've dealt with yet. And it's how social media is used, specifically Facebook, to draw people into paying you money, right? You might not think that a lot of this Facebook stuff is as sinister as I do. And I want you to weigh in on that in a minute. But I've been getting a lot of feedback from my audience. I do these like weekly discussion groups for my Universiversity. That was the virtual summit that I ran last year. And we've just kind of built a community around that where we do regular calls. We talk about current events. We try to apply some of the lessons of that summit to the things that happened in 2020. And I'm sure 2021 is going to be plenty crazy. I've actually been getting more audience feedback than I've ever received before.
And one of the comments has been that I am kind of hysterical about the power of social media. And with every story that I hear about Facebook or Google or any of the ways these algorithms work to manipulate people, and I start going, this is the biggest problem in the world. I understand that maybe I could like moderate my response to some of this stuff a little better. I do think it is a problem. I do think it is a current that most people don't even know they're in, and it's taking them somewhere, and they're completely oblivious to that fact, like how social media works. So that's basically my position. Well, I understand that maybe I need to calm down a little bit, and I don't need to go like full social dilemma, Cambridge Analytica paranoia. Sure. But I am very concerned about this. I'm very concerned about where it's leading people. I do think it is a threat to individual liberty and autonomy in a non-state way. And people who are more liberty-minded or, you know, like define themselves as libertarians have not done a good job of addressing what I see as a problem. So, and an impediment or something that is taking freedom away from people, that cognitive liberty that we've talked about a lot on my show and others. So I want you to weigh in on that, and then we'll start building out the bad side of social media, if you'll play along with me, if you don't think there is one. But go ahead.
I think that there is a bad side to it. I also think that there's an incredible good side to it.
Sure.
Not just because I make a lot of money off of Facebook and YouTube, but also because the conversation that we're able to have now, even though there's a lot of echo chambers built and there's a lot of algorithmic exclusion to certain parts of the conversation, depending on what you want to hear and what the algorithm decides that you need to hear, there's potential for voices to get out there that weren't before. And so from an activist kind of point of view, I think that it's been an amazing tool. Now, in the last few years, the amount of censorship is worrying to me. Mm. So where I kind of differ on like the social dilemma and that side of the conversation, I think they don't understand how advertising works. They give too much power to advertising. It's obvious that they've never ran ad campaigns. Otherwise, they wouldn't be saying 90% of the stuff that they say. And I think the real danger that is in social media that I see right now is censorship. I am more concerned with the fact that people are losing their ability to free speech. I'm not as concerned about what people do with free speech as I am with the fact that some people don't get to exercise the same free speech that others do. There's definitely opinions that are welcome on certain social media sites and opinions that aren't. There's double standards and they're growing more and more blatant. So I think that's the more troubling concern for me. I understand where people are coming from. I also have concerns about privacy. I also have concerns about manipulation. But being that I've run advertising campaigns for the last, 10 years now, I think that people have a very, if you haven't ran an ad campaign, if you haven't wasted a lot of money on an idea that you thought was going to knock it out of the ballpark, if you haven't been the person that has to run 8 flops before you get one that actually converts, it's really easy to believe that all of these nefarious things that Facebook is doing give you superhuman power over the psyche of your audience, but it's not quite that way, at least for the advertisers. I think that Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, with the algorithm and also mainstream media, the way that they pick and choose which stories they run, I think they have a lot more power in controlling the conversation than advertisers have, because we don't get access to everything that is, people have misconceptions about what advertisers actually have access to when we run ads on YouTube, when we run ads on Facebook.
Sure. Okay. So let me build out this idea of good versus evil in this case, like really looking at what you do. So I've gone through, your course material, the name of your training is called Social Media Shitposting for Fun and Profit, correct?
Yeah. That's
now, and obviously I'm on board with this. I love what you do. And I think you have a very genuine, I would say honest approach to taking people from like cold traffic or all the way at the far end, you're familiar with like the five levels of awareness in marketing. So for people who are unfamiliar with this, it goes from like what we would call a blue ocean to a red ocean, meaning in the red ocean, there's more of a feeding frenzy. As people get closer to a point where they're ready to buy something and they start using keywords that have intent in their searches, right? Like if somebody searches financial planning, that is like very exploratory. They're problem aware, but they might not be solution aware yet. So they're just kind of feeling around. But if they're like financial planner in Phoenix, Arizona, they've moved closer like to most aware, right? I'm looking for a product. I'm looking for a service. So the continuum in the five levels of awareness is the blue ocean, unaware. So people move from there to being problem aware, and then to solution aware, and then to specific product aware, and then basically at the final stage, they're ready to buy something. So you're able to, just through know, like, and trust, take people who might not even understand that they have a problem or they need a service, and you build a relationship with them, right? So you're kind of bringing people into your world by entertaining them or connecting with them in these various ways through Facebook. While Google is not as good as Facebook, and we can talk about the distinction as well, is basically using more, I would say, subliminal and certainly covert methods of moving people through levels of awareness through these predictive behavior techniques that, like we talked about last time, are very behavioral, are in many ways very intrusive. So you're both trying to do the same thing, but you're doing it in a way that is more like above board and honest, I would say. So that's the distinction I make. And the reason why it's an important distinction is if it's happening below the table, that is obviously, just like we see all these things that happen in the CIA and all these secret committees and roundtable groups, like in the conspiracy world, if things are not happening in the public eye, it obviously creates tremendous opportunities for corruption. So what Facebook is doing, and these data scraping and data collection agencies that work with Facebook, all of this stuff that is going on without public awareness, there's this knowledge disparity happening right now that I think is very dangerous. What people can know about you, if you're just the average user, as they call them, or consumer, what can be known about you without you even knowing that people have the capability of knowing these things is an expanding danger, as far as I'm concerned, or certainly has the potential to be.
Again, I'm torn on the issue. I agree with you and I see your concerns. I also, having a background in marketing and web development, a lot of the like things that people get concerned about when they actually do go and read the terms and conditions, a lot of the stuff that people freak out about, it's because they're ignorant. Not to be like diminishing of their concerns or whatever, but if you sign up for the Facebook app and Facebook says we take control of your microphone and we take control of your camera, people might be like, oh, that's freaky and creepy in 1984. But at the same time, they want to be able to take a picture and post it directly from their cell phone to their Facebook account. They want to be able to go live from their cell phone. So in order to do those things, Facebook has to have access to your microphone and to your camera. Then there's also the fact that a lot of times people complain about, hey, I was just talking about this with my sister, and as soon as I had my cell phone in my pocket while I was talking about it, and the next time I popped up on Facebook, I saw an ad for the exact same thing we were just talking about. Is Facebook listening? And there have been admittances. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google, they've admitted that they do listen in. People put smart TVs in their houses and the smart TVs listen to them. People put Alexa and Echo in their house, and those things, Siri, they all listen to them too. So my kind of thing is, if people are willing to sacrifice their privacy, which more and more people are willing to do, if they're going to put their information out there, I don't really have a problem with using that information to strategize my marketing campaigns. And you said what Facebook does is kind of below board and what I do is above board. I don't know if I really actually agree with that, because when I'm prospecting, I'm going to go to people's private Facebook posts or their pages, or I'm going to stalk them in groups, and I'm going to collect data on them to make sure that they're somebody I actually want to work with, to make sure that they're somebody who actually qualifies for my services. And they don't specifically give me permission to go through their posts to kind of analyze where they're at in their business, what type of personality they have, what type of situation their business is in at the time. They don't give me permission to do that. They just post the stuff on Facebook, and I'm kind of doing the same thing that Facebook does, without their permission. And then I'm picking out who do I want to, out of the people who have engaged with my posts recently, who do I actually want to work with? I'm kind of doing the same stuff that people would complain about Facebook doing, would complain about YouTube doing. I don't obviously have the back end coding that Facebook does, but I am doing a lot of the same stuff.
But they're giving you some level of access if you become friends with them, right? Now, obviously, you could say they're giving Facebook some level of access just by using the platform. But also, there's probably dozens, if not hundreds, of data points that you're not going to have access to that Facebook does.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
And that can be scraped and sold. Like, you're not combing through somebody's wall, scraping data, building a profile, and then selling it to somebody else.
No, I'm not. But that's because that just doesn't fit my business model. It doesn't fit the way that I want to do business. But I do know that there are marketers that do that kind of stuff. I know that, especially on LinkedIn, scraping people's information is a really big problem right now. A lot of people are getting signed up for email lists and text message lists that they never signed up for because people are doing exactly that. They're being hired by these marketing agencies to go and scrape people's information from LinkedIn. And so, people are shitty sometimes to each other, and marketers and big Silicon Valley tech agencies are ran by those same kind of people, I guess.
Well, sure. And I think another thing that's worth pointing out here, and this, I don't think this is necessarily nefarious, but I think it's something that a lot of people do not know. To introduce this, I would just talk about the difference between like what search traffic is and contextual traffic. And search traffic is basically people looking for solutions through Google. I think about 70% of the internet is using Chrome. Obviously, Google has a range of services and they can collect all these data points about you and remarket to you based on behavior changes. But it's primarily based on search, and then they're putting together a bigger picture depending on the other Google services that you use. But Facebook is more contextual. They say in their own internal documents that go back years, they say they have thousands of data points that they're basically able to combine together and predict behavior. So we've all had that experience. It's gone beyond, is my phone listening to me? And I think people are starting to ask the question, is my phone reading my mind? Yeah, I get why I'm getting this ad, but those are just my thoughts. Maybe I wrote it in a journal. And one of the things that Facebook is able to do that I think a lot of people might be unaware of this, that they can monitor your behavior off the site, because almost any place you go on the internet, and I know like going to websites, like going to actual websites is way less popular than it used to be. The internet is basically Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. I mean, where else? A few others, Amazon. But Facebook knows every time you click on a page that has a Facebook share button. If you can share the content from a certain page on Facebook just by clicking a button, Facebook knows you were there if you're logged in. Maybe, I'm not even sure you need to be logged in to Facebook. I just think to make the distinction, I get maybe in principle they're the same, but the number of data points and the number of ways that, like, you can watch people on Facebook, but Facebook can watch people almost anywhere on the internet. You know, unless they're opening they have some kind of security or privacy system set up where they can open every different program or every different website they want to visit in its own virtual machine that's isolated from Facebook's access. And that technology does exist. I know somebody who builds these machines and sells them. But most people are exposed to Facebook beyond being on Facebook. So that once they leave Facebook, I think in a lot of ways they might be out of the reach of somebody like you.
Partially. So let me play devil's advocate here real quick. If I am looking to get a divorce and I live in Denver, Colorado, and I go to Google and I say divorce lawyers, I want Google to know that I'm in Denver, Colorado. I don't want them showing me divorce lawyers in New York or California. I don't want my front page being the top U.S. divorce lawyers. I also would prefer that Google knows how much money I make per year so that they can tell me, oh, this is the best divorce lawyer for your budget. I would prefer if Google knows whether I have kids or not so that they can send, so they can say, oh, you're a male and you've got two kids and your concerns about the divorce are more than just money. They're about visitation. They're about being held hostage over visitation rights. They're about all of these different situations. So I'm just looking for a divorce lawyer, but I would prefer in my search that Google knows these things about me. Also, if I'm a divorce lawyer advertising and I represent single or I represent women who don't have any children, who are trying to get alimony payments, or they have two kids and they're trying to get alimony payments, and their husbands are rich, and I know that I can milk both of them for as much money as I possibly can, I want to make sure that my ads aren't being shown to a meth head who's divorcing her alcoholic junkie husband who doesn't have any money to spend. And those are kind of extremes, but the fact of the matter is, whether it's Google or if it's on Facebook, the more data points that they have, the more accurate the ads are for me specifically. And if I'm going to have to watch ads, if I'm going to have to see ads, I would rather see ads for things that are actually relevant to me. And if I'm going to be paying for ads, I would rather only be showing, if I'm paying Facebook to put my ads in front of people, I don't want, if I'm a high-priced divorce attorney, I don't want Facebook showing my ads to people who are meth addicts and looking to get divorced. I only want them being shown to people who can actually afford my services.
So the high level of targeting is good for most marketers. Like the marketers that I've listened to talk about it, they're like, this technology is absolutely amazing. And some are more like, again, problem aware than others. Like, yeah, it is a little dicey what is possible with this. But as far as a tool for targeting people in really super specific, accurate ways, it's kind of a dream come true.
Well, I don't want to give the wrong impression. It's, first of all, it's better for the user as well. Like I said, if I'm on Facebook, I don't want to see ads that has nothing to do with me. And I've had the experience recently where I logged into YouTube and I wasn't in my account. I was in somebody else's account and I got an ad that played for girls. Don't you hate it when you sit down on a couch at somebody else's house and when you get up, there's a big blood stain? And I was like, whoa, this ad is not for me at all. So I don't want to be targeted with ads that don't speak to me. But also, with all of this marketing, precision targeting, all of this stuff, I think the misconception is, now our ads only go to people who are going to buy and we're going to be able to manipulate people more frequently. And what I've experienced is now instead of having one out of 20 advertising campaigns that really works, I get one out of 8 advertising campaigns that really work. I'm still flopping 8 times out of 10 or 9 times out of 10. So it's not like all of this targeting gives you the exact perfect people at the exact perfect time that they're willing to buy. Every marketer out there still wastes a lot of money on bad campaigns, even with the targeting focused in as well as it is. So I think that those are just some things to think about. I do have concerns about the privacy, but at the same time, I don't think that people have an accurate understanding of how much of their information is out there and how it's actually being used and how much power these companies actually have. I think that we ascribe to them a little bit more knowledge than they actually have.
So let me just give another example. There was a leaked Facebook document in 2018. Oh, actually, no, this was earlier. I don't know when this document leaked, but this was an experiment they ran in 2012 and 2013. So imagine, and this is AI technology, so imagine where this is now. It was called Massive Scale Contagion Experiments. And what they determined was, or what the experiment was to use subliminal cues on certain Facebook pages to see if they could alter emotion and behavior. And the outcomes were, yes, we can do this. And we can do this bypassing, finger quotes, bypassing user awareness, right? So that was 7-8 years ago. So Those are the kinds of things. And once we see, like, you know, this become political or enter into the political through things like Cambridge Analytica, it's extended way beyond just, you know, efficient marketing. Whether you're a marketer or you accept this is the playing field that you have to play on, you understand that you are the product of social media. If you're using anything for free, you're the product. We know this and we accept this, and at least, you know, target the best ads you can for, you know, my current needs and my current economic status, my location, et cetera, et cetera. But it's moved way beyond that at this point. And I think some of the impacts that it had on the political system, and then we can also get into, like, you know, we could look at the major players in who is criticizing what's happening. So we have the social dilemma, which we've talked a lot in our, like, we've talked about it a lot in our, like, premium content at School Sucks. We've had several in-depth conversations about the social dilemma. I want you to weigh in on that. A movie that came out last year, or at this point, I guess 2019, called The Great Hack. I don't know if you're familiar with that one. It kind of focuses around this professor named David Carroll and his and a couple other, like, people who were working with Cambridge Analytica and trying to blow the whistle on that. And a lot of the suspicions they thought Facebook was engaged in a cover-up as far as what was really going on there. So that film explores that. Mark Weinstein being the third one. He's the founder of MeWe. So Social Dilemma takes it from a kind of, like, societal impact standpoint. The Great Hack takes it from a privacy standpoint. Mark Weinstein deals with it from both, and he gave a TED Talk and, you know, didn't mention MeWe explicitly, but, you know, talked about the problems with the current social media landscape. And then another big one is Shoshana Zuboff. Have you heard of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism? It's a very large book, and she's made the rounds, I think, for a couple years at this point. She's kind of taking it from this economic standpoint, but she's kind of framing this, I mean, surveillance capitalism as a term for what all this is makes me skeptical. But she's also kind of calling for this, like, 21st century raised awareness about collective interest and collective action in a response to this thing, and obviously calls for regulation. So it's easy to dismiss, like, a lot of the players who appear in The Social Dilemma or The Great Hack, or the people who are doing the messaging on The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, as people who just have very, very different economic ideas from ours and have never, like, really tried to sell anything or market anything. So they're seeing this all from a very one-sided perspective. But I'm also saying, well, are they wrong about the dangers of this thing, even if their framing is, like, not something we'd agree with? So how do you feel about that term? I bet you're not going to like it. Surveillance capitalism.
Believe it or not, I actually have concerns about it. Like I said, I take a very nuanced approach to all of this. I understand some of the dangers to this stuff. My bread and butter is made off of, I mean, the whole point of this series is emotional manipulators for hire. That's what I do for a living, is I emotionally manipulate people into buying things. I don't really think of it as nefarious as that, but I do understand the concerns about it. I also, though, I just want to say, I being somebody that does this stuff for a living, it's not as nefarious as it's painted. And I think that a more nuanced approach to it, a more looking at it from both sides, because I know a lot of marketers that also have a lot of problems with the amount of data mining, the amount of intrusions into our privacy. I know marketers that are against this stuff as well. I think that, like most issues, the problem is the loudest people on either side are people who haven't actually walked even 10 feet in the shoes of the people on the other side. And so, like most issues nowadays, it's the least informed of the other side people on either side that get the most attention.
Right. So, it's interesting. I mean, this is somebody from this Shoshana Zuboff is from the Harvard Business School, and I definitely see her as an outside observer. But a couple of the things that she talks about that I found interesting is she builds out a history of how we got here. And this whole, like, what they call surveillance capitalism has been in the works for about 20 years at this point. And her story, as far as, like, the origin of this, is that when the tech bubble was kind of collapsing in the late 90s. And a lot of these companies who were like poised for a major growth stage before that, Google included, started to kind of panic and see this as like, well, all these, you know, venture capitalists are going to pull out if we can't offer something new. And Google kind of led the charge, again, very under the radar. Nobody knew what they were doing when they tried to like regroup around the year 2000, right? So 20 years ago. And there was no discussion of this anywhere in the public, but it was basically like, all right, our new model as far as revenue. And it just in that little the brief period between like 2000 and 2004, the revenue line of these companies increased 3,000% while almost nobody knew what they were doing. And the way they basically raised the bar for investment from venture capital is like this data mining. Right? We will collect data, we will build these profiles, and people won't even know that we're doing it. And she had this other really interesting story that kind of went along with that. At the time, the first discussion of the idea of surveillance capitalism, even though it didn't have that name yet, was 2004, when Georgia Tech engineers were conceiving of the smart home. Have you heard about the smart home? Ironically, the first person I ever heard who had one was Bill Gates, right? There were all these stories about when you go into Bill Gates' house and you go from one room to another, you wear a little bracelet and it changes the room to your custom settings. And they were trying to like, can an average middle-class family have a smart home that, you know, does all this customization by sending data? And one of the conclusions was like, this is obviously a major privacy concern. And, you know, the devices that send data in the house have to exist in a closed loop where only the occupants can access the data. And only the occupants are able to decide if the data goes beyond the house for any reason, as far as like providing service or anything like that. By 2017, there was another study, I think, at the University of London about the Nest thermostat, which was a smart device, a smart home device that Google wound up taking over. And now I think it's just called Nest. And they said that in order to like implement this before Google took it over, there were 1,000 privacy policies in place as far as like where the data could go or where it could be sent that a user would have to consider. So Nest would take the data, send it to Google, and then Google would send it to third parties. And this is like your most personal, like what are you doing in your home? What are your home preferences? So that is basically all of social media today. I mean, those are part of like the case that Zuboff lays out in the Age of Surveillance Capitalism and her discussions about it, that this thing that in 2004, Georgia Tech engineers are going, geez, this is quite an intrusion if we don't figure out a way to close the data loop. And by 2017, it's just like there's a thousand individual ways for your data to get out to third party data scrapers just by monitoring your in-home activity, just what you're doing around the house. There's all these data points that can be collected. Now you move that online, what you're searching for, either above board or incognito, who you're searching for on Facebook, all of these patterns of behavior. And you've gone to a level of intrusion that these Georgia Tech engineers never could have imagined just 15 years ago. So that's basically her case. I think in some ways it is persuasive, but I will also agree with you that she's coming at it. Her point of view is colored by not understanding a non-nefarious use for it. It has always been the name of the game in marketing to like, I have this existing audience. How do I make a similar audience, you know, or how do I find a similar audience to what's already working? How do I build profiles about current users, potential users, people who are more out in that blue sea and don't even know they're looking for me yet? So all of this stuff is extremely useful, not for manipulating people into giving you money, but for matching people's needs with what you have. So, but if you're missing that, it all just seems like pure evil.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess there's two things to keep in mind. Number one, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, we've got, as marketers, as prospectors, a lot of times we have giant lists of information about the people that we're prospecting. We've got all kinds of tools, digital tools out there, that CRM tools that make it easy for us to manage all of the information that we have on people, how many times we've followed up with them, which stage of the process they're at, all of the contact information that we've acquired on them. Like, we have the ability to do all of this too. And so that's kind of probably desensitized me a little bit to the concerns that maybe I would have had, or maybe you might be expressing right now. But I will also say this, I don't have an Alexa in my house. I don't have a Siri in my house. I do have a cell phone. We're recording this call on Zoom and broadcasting it to a particular digital audience right now. I always kind of do the pros and cons of each piece of equipment. I'm not a big fan of the smart homes, but I have friends. One of the guys that is on my team that does a lot of the coding and network development work for some of the stuff behind the scenes for my business, his house is completely head to toe smart house. He can check on any room in his house from his cell phone, from anywhere in the world. He can check what's inside of his fridge from his cell phone, and he loves it. I would never want that kind of intrusion into my own privacy. I don't need to check the expiration date on my milk from the couch. I can just get up and walk to the refrigerator. If I'm at the store and I need to know, I guess I should have done a better job of tracking and maintaining my groceries before I left to go to the store. It's a trade-off. And when you talk about personal liberty, I feel the same way I feel about it as I do as fast food. I'm not a fan of fast food. I don't eat fast food myself. But if other people want to eat fast food, they're giving up a lot of their health. They're giving up a lot of their freedom and mobility in life. They're giving up years of their own life, but they have that choice. And I'm not going to tell them that they don't have that choice. So when it comes to all of this stuff, you can either use it as a producer, you can use it as a consumer, or you can just opt out altogether. Nobody's forcing you to have a Facebook account. Nobody's forcing you to have a Google account. I choose to use them on the production side. I choose to use Facebook as a tool rather than, I don't consume Facebook very much. I just go on there. I shitpost. I know what gets engagement. I know how to emotionally manipulate people in order to get them engaging with my stuff and get people raising their hands to see who I want to do business with, who I want to sell to. But I don't get caught up in Facebook. I don't do the 1,000 comment thread arguments with people. I don't do the join all the Facebook groups and give Facebook all that information on me. To an extent, I give it up to the amount that it serves me, and to the point where it doesn't serve me, I have personal volition over my own actions, and I don't partake in the aspects of these things that I don't feel serve me.
I completely understand. And the last alarmist words that I will put into this presentation before we move on to an exploration of all of the great work you do on Facebook and some of the principles behind how you do it. You know, these people who are trying to sound the alarm, mostly from like this left-wing anti-capitalist point of view, I think one of the buzzwords that they're going to try to employ is inequality, right? Now, are they wrong? We might not. That word is kind of like so overused that we hear it and we just go, I don't know what you mean. That word doesn't have any precision, right? And it's just like a thing that left-wing people say to annoy everybody else at this point, unfortunately, because obviously it's a real word. It's a real problem. And if I was going to replace inequality with knowledge asymmetry, right? Knowledge asymmetry basically makes every nefarious thing in the world possible. So I'm somebody for over a decade, I've done a show about school, which is one of, by and large in society, the hidden currents that people are pulled through, and they don't necessarily understand where they're going and why, right? They are not captains of their own ship. You know, they're not writing their own scripts. And if I see something that has a lot of the same properties of school or other applications of behaviorism that are like outside of school, like school uses behaviorism, like we talked about last time, but lots of other things do as well. If I see people in a current and they don't know they're in a current and they don't know where they're going, You know, I see that as obviously a problem or an interference with individual liberty. So to a certain extent, behavior needs to be controlled or managed to be properly predicted. So again, just to kind of make this transition and to make this distinction between what you do and what's possible to do below board on Facebook is if Facebook is able to collect these data points, and Google can do this too. Google can't do it as well as Facebook, but they can collect these data points to identify where somebody is at a certain part of the buying cycle, right? For a certain type of marketer or a certain type of product that is using the data scraping to make a sale. Facebook can, you know, use the algorithm to basically tweak behavior to move somebody from the blue sea to the red sea, to raise their buying intent without the person even knowing that they're being manipulated. So being able to refine this prediction process the way Facebook does it is the diminishing of individual autonomy. In many ways, for me, this is the new school. This is the new scientific management. And meanwhile, you and I have both been in this kind of like libertarian world that has nothing to say about any of this. Political libertarianism has no answers to this specific problem, right? But if we look at all these different theaters of individual liberty on a spectrum from like, you know, the most desirable complete liberty to the least desirable, like Vince Vaughn in Brawl in Cell Block 99, that's the continuum that all these things operate on. Our relationships, our friendships, our finances, our health, our cognitive liberty, professional freedom, all of these different things, all of these different theaters. Like, this is one that if people don't get like digital or data freedom, I think it threatens to disrupt almost everything else in their lives. It can. It has the potential. I'm not saying that it will, but it can compromise all others. So, you know, I've heard libertarians talk about this and like, go make your own Facebook. You know, and they don't understand that this is a project that has been in the works since the tech bubble exploded in the late 90s. And all of these companies were saying like, all right, well, we have no way to make money. We have no way to get funding from VCs unless we come up with some way to use this technology in a way that is basically covert. And, you know, Google started that project 20 years ago. So the idea that there's going to be any, like that MeWe is really going to disrupt Facebook or whatever, or that Gab is going to knock out Twitter, these are just silly ideas. Not to mention that they defy the purpose of social media because they're just sending people who are all in the same echo chamber to a place. But that's a separate problem. So from like a freedom standpoint, I'm sure, and I've had a couple guests, like Moritz Berling and Skinner Lane were on my show, and we did a whole series about this a couple years ago, and they were actually promoting like these platforms need to require skin in the game. People need to pay to use them, right? There needs to be new social media platforms where people put skin in the game. Otherwise, this is just the town dump. And there's going to be all kinds of hidden costs for using the town dump and tragedy of the commons and all that. And we certainly see that. And that very cliched idea at this point, if you're not paying for something, you are the product, right? So finding a way, we did a big exploration about that. And it's actually, those shows are right on the front page of my website, schoolsucksproject.com right now. So that's a good transition to what you do. And it actually takes us back to Blair Warren, who we talked about in the very first episode of this show. And that seems to be the key that unlocks your approach to Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like my approach to marketing in general. And my approach to Facebook is very much influenced by what I've learned through marketing and copywriting. And I think that that's, I guess, the goals. When most people are on Facebook, they have different goals. Some people are there because they need something to kill the time while they're sitting on the toilet or they're in line at the bank. Some people are on Facebook because they want to get angry and fight with people who disagree with them. Some people are on Facebook because they want to see their friends and family post pictures of their food and their children and whatever. I'm pretty much on Facebook because I want to market. I want to sell stuff. And Facebook and LinkedIn and YouTube are the places that my audience is at. And particularly for me, my audience is mainly on Facebook, but I might be shifting that. I might be changing my audience a little bit in the future. We'll see what happens. But yeah, I approach Facebook from I'm not trying to change the world. I'm not trying to get a bunch of likes on my pictures of my kids or my food that I just made. I'm there basically because I want to sell some stuff. And then sometimes And this is probably self-sabotaging, but I also do it in a way to kind of separate who I want to work with from who I don't want to work with. Sometimes I post my political opinions there as well, maybe a little bit more than is healthy.
I don't know. I totally disagree. I think that is the opposite of self-sabotaging. How much money have you saved on Advil by not having to work with certain people because they were going to become a pain in the ass and you couldn't foresee that? But you've said, you've like gotten messages from people who said things like, "Yo, I wanted to work with you, but then I saw the thing that you posted and now," I mean, that's happened, right?
Oh, it's happened a lot.
That's amazing. That's great, I think.
The opposite has happened. I've had people hit me up and they said, "Hey, we've been looking for a copywriter for 3 months now. And this one really spicy post that you probably got a lot of hate for is the reason that we decided we wanted to work with you over other people." So it kind of, it's a filtering out process, and I lose potential work, but it, like you said, it might be people I wouldn't want to work with. And I also have people that say, "Hey, you're the only guy we would work with because of the fact that you posted this." That may have made a lot of people angry, but we saw the response and we're on board and we want to work with you. So yeah, I mean, it again, double-edged sword. It's kind of like a recurring theme as well.
Sure. So for people who might not have heard our first episode, I wanted to repeat the one sentence persuasion, and then we can talk about practices that you put in place from there on Facebook, as far as like what people interact with and why, because it, I think it relates to that. So the 28 words again are: people will do anything for those who encourage their dreams, justify their failures, allay their fears, confirm their suspicions, and help them throw rocks at their enemies. Man, that hits harder today. You know, like just like watching everything that happened in Washington, D.C. We're recording this on the night of January 6th. And geez, I might not be able to turn this around until Monday. And it could be a very, very different world that we're living in by the time people are hearing this. But it motivates me to try and get it done tomorrow. So, yeah, it's just thinking about the role that echo chambers, social media, mainstream media have played in the current situation that is sort of unraveling in front of our eyes in Washington, D.C., and probably soon beyond Washington, D.C., those 28 words seem more resonant than they did in the past.
Yeah, and specifically when it comes to the way that I post things, because I'm not really there to be a political activist, although some of my stuff is political. I do have a preference for people that think a specific way or people whose values are a specific way. I don't want to work with corporations that are trying to market to the woke audience. I don't want to work with people that their marketing teams are a bunch of kids fresh out of college who are into all of these social justice ideals. I've taken on projects like that and it's been a complete nightmare. And I don't want to work in that type of environment. So I try to filter some of that stuff out. But my strategy for when I post things, it's mainly, I ask myself, the people I want to work with, the people that I want to reach, are they going to agree with this? Are they going to, when they read it, are they going to be able to say to themselves, "That's how I feel. I'm glad somebody was willing to step up and say this." If the answer to that is yes, it's probably going to get a lot of likes. It's probably going to get a lot of shares. And then I want to ask myself, so I want to speak for my audience more than I want to speak for myself. And then I also want to ask myself, am I speaking for my audience's audience? When they share this, is their audience going to be like, "Yes, I want to say this too. Yes, I'm so glad that somebody said this." If I can get the people who share my content, if I can get my audience to share my content and then their audience shares my content, that's when Facebook, that's when YouTube, that's when Twitter, that's when LinkedIn, when they start seeing the secondary shares, when your audience shares it and then their audience starts sharing it, that's when the algorithms are like, "Oh, this is something that needs to be boosted." And that's when they start pushing your stuff into the timelines, into the news feeds of a bunch of other people's feeds. And so that's kind of like my basic approach. You mentioned the Blair Warren 28 words, one sentence persuasion. That's kind of what I'm doing. I'm asking, does this meet those qualifications? Does this help them say what they want to say to the world? Will this help their audience say what they want to say to the world? Most of my content, whether it's Facebook posts or same thing with sales pages, emails, anything that I write, I'm thinking, who's my audience? How do they feel? What do they want to say to the world? And if you go through my emails or you go through my Facebook page posts, a lot of times that is the comments that end up, "I'm so glad you said this. You hit the nail on the head. I have to share this. I'm stealing this." It's because I'm speaking, or I'm asking myself before I post it, does this help my audience? If they can't formulate the words themselves, but I can formulate it in a way that they say, "Yes, that's exactly it," then I know it's going to be a good sales letter. Then I know it's going to be a good sales email. Then I know it's going to be a good viral Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn or YouTube post.
So the secret to going viral then is to say what your audience wants their audience to hear. Right, which is not how most people use Facebook. It's not how I've experimented with this since I went through your training, and those things get like 10 times the likes and shares of anything else that I do. And, you know, it's kind of like the medium is the, I feel like in every show for the last like 2 weeks, I've said it's kind of like the medium is the message. But with Instagram, right? Like people are on Instagram to, I don't know, see butts or fitness tips or memes or whatever. And I use social media as like a photo album, or like almost like a pitch deck of my work, right? Like, look at this. Here's a show that took 10 hours of my time and will take you 2 hours of your time. Please like and share. And people go, "Fuck you. That's not why I'm here." Right? But if I literally like take a screenshot on my phone of a meme that somebody else posted and then put it in Instagram and put a little pithy caption in, that I did that yesterday. It was 45 seconds of work to get 110 likes on Instagram versus 7 hours of work to make a podcast, and that got like 7 likes. So that's just the medium, right? People aren't scrolling through Instagram to go, what can I find that will take up 2 hours of my time? It's the opposite of why they're there. So understanding the medium that you're operating in as far as gaining exposure, and the bigger, you've been very good at, like, you know, because you're a podcaster too, and you've probably been able to build an audience around creating that know, like, and trust you engage people in different ways, right? Like sometimes, like, here, this is a home run. This is what you want to say to the people who are annoying you, like in your newsfeed. Sometimes you want to kind of provoke people in your own circle. You take all these kinds of different approaches. But yeah, I mean, that biggest one of like being the advocate for like, "Here, look, I'm a copywriter. I know exactly how to say the thing that you can't figure out how to say to all these nitwits that are posting this bullshit in your newsfeed. Here it is." You know, that's why you get shared by me with a trophy, you know? So if we could talk a little bit about maybe some of the ways to increase reach for people who are, you know, trying to market themselves or a service or a media project like I do, or people who are just looking to build engagement to do better outreach because they still think outreach is a thing that's possible. I mean, God bless you if you do. But if you are, you know, promoting yourself, promoting, a personal brand or a product or, some form of media, there are ways to increase your reach. And there are distinct styles of posts you can do to create some variety. So we can talk about that. And I don't want to give the whole training away, but I think that would be good value for people listening to go through those two lists.
I think I'm going to completely divert it because I have not gone back through the training. Most of this stuff is just like who I am when I put that training together. Mm-hmm. It was just like, okay, let me think out loud about the way that I put this stuff together. But I'm going to take a slightly different approach. And if you want to add anything to it or pull me back in.
Sure. Yeah. I love it.
I like to approach it from what do people want and give them what they want before I ask them for what I want. So I know that I want them to pay attention to me and I want them to buy my stuff. What do they want though? When they go to Facebook, what is it that they want? And not just what do they want to consume, but what do they emotionally want? They want to feel smarter than people. They want to feel like they've got secret information that other people don't have. They want to feel validated in the way that they feel in the opinions that they hold. So a lot of the times I'm going to give them that. I'm going to say when I'm creating content, if I want them to share it, what do they want to get out of sharing it? They want to look smarter. They want to look like they broke the news. They want to look like they've got the secret information. They want to look like they're part of the elite. So these are the things, they want to look, they want to feel like they're the leader. They want to fit. This is my audience. This might not be everybody's audience, but this is my audience. And I think that there's a lot of that in everybody. They want to feel accepted. They want to feel special. They want to feel like they have secret information that nobody else has. And so when I post stuff, I post stuff that I know that if they take it and they also post it, it's going to give them that sense of feeling about themselves. It's going to, if they take it, they're going to be, when they post it, they're going to be like, look how witty I am. Look how smart I am. Look how much access to higher levels of information I have than the average MSNBC watcher has. So when I'm posting stuff, a lot of times I'm asking myself, what do people want out of their social media experience? And there's a book, there's a couple books on why ideas go viral, why ideas spread, why things get contagious. And the biggest aspect of it is that the people, when they share it, it's because it gives them a sense of superiority over the other people in their social circle. So a lot of times that's what I'm just doing. I'm there to provide stuff that if people share it, they get a sense of superiority over the other people in their circle of friends. And by sharing enough stuff like that, I'll share 8 or 9 posts that give them the ability to feel that way. And then I'll post my own stuff. Most people approach social media like this. I'm going to log in. I'm going to tell the world about me, 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 me. And hopefully somebody pays attention and I can get some new podcast listeners or I can get some new subscribers to my newsletter.
People do this. Yeah.
Yeah. And I do the opposite. I log in and I say, I'm going to create stuff that helps my audience say me, 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 me.
Yeah.
And then once they've shared enough of my stuff, then I say, hey, by the way, here's something about me. I've helped you express yourself. I've helped you feel smarter than everybody in your circle. 8 out of the last 10 things I've posted, here's 2 things that you can help me out with. And then this is the craziest thing. A lot of my blatant sales messages end up getting hundreds of shares. A lot of times I'll post something that's just a blatant sales pitch and 2 days later it'll have 100 shares. And I don't know any marketers that are able to pull that off like I'm able to pull it off. And that's why I don't put very much money into paid advertising on Facebook anymore. Most of my sales just come strictly from organic marketing there.
Yeah, I really realize that like gratitude posts do really well, like shouting people out or even noting accomplishments. Like people really seem to like that. And very rarely, unless it's like a really special piece of media, those are the things that go most unnoticed. But I'm interested in just like building that idea out a little more of getting them to say me, me, me. Like, what are some examples of how to do that?
Well, for what you just mentioned, shouting people out, occasionally I'll do a shout out post where I'm just like, hey, if you can't afford me or if you can't work with me because I'm too booked up right now, here's 3 other copywriters that I absolutely stand behind. And I'll list off 3 copywriters that I think people should check out. And what that does is those 3 copywriters say, oh, I got tagged in a post where this guy's shouting me out. I'm going to make sure it shows up on my page. And now my post is on their page. And now their audience sees my post when they go to their page. And now their audience is my audience. All of their friends are like, hey, this person I really like just got a shout out. I'll go ahead and share this as well. And you get that kind of reflective glory. So if I shout out 3 people who were my mentors, or 3 people who taught me a lot, 3 people who were my favorite. If I'm friends with 3 people who I recently read their books and I really loved their books, again, if I tag them in it and I'm like, hey, these are the 3 books that made the biggest impression on me over the last 6 months. And I tagged the 3 different authors. Now they're going to want to put that because it's about them. They're like, oh, this is a post about me. I'm going to make sure that it gets approved for my timeline. And then all of their audience, I have that reflective glory with all of their audience now. I've got, it's kind of like the halo effect. Everyone who reads that is like, oh, Nathan was influenced by such and such. Oh, Nathan's mentored by such and such. And so now if they know that big name person, now they're like, oh, Nathan's associated with this big name person. And it draws that, that association that now I'm kind of on the same stage as that person that they look up to is. And so I'm failing for the word, but I get that reflective glory. And Those people are more likely to share them as well. So it is a shout out. It is a post where I'm kind of stealing some halo effect from them, but it allows them to say me, just like the gratitude posts where occasionally I'll just post something where I'm like, hey, if you're reading this, I appreciate having you in my life. Or, hey, Landon Porter, a mutual friend of ours, he loves to always say, I love some of you, I like most of you. And one time, a couple of weeks back, I just posted, I love some of you. I just straight up stole part of his catch line. And man, that post blew up because people are like, oh, somebody said that they love me on Facebook. And again, it's about me. I'm scrolling through all this stuff and everybody's talking about their own things. Here's my cool new motorcycle. Here's my kids at the park. Here's what we had for dinner last night. And then there's a post that says, hey, I love you. And they're like, me? You love me? Oh, I'm going to love this Facebook post. So yeah, feeding into the me, it sounds bad. It sounds like we're taking advantage of people's narcissism. And in a way, that is exactly what I'm doing.
Well, and that's been actually one of the big criticisms of the social dilemma is it's like another just like taking people's, and that is like just a feature of left-wing presentations or assessments of things, is that it's like, how can we frame the problem in a way that it steals people's power? Right? That it steals their agency, that it steals their autonomy, and makes everybody go, oh, well, who's going to save us? Who's going to regulate this thing so we're all safe? You know, one of the things that I think becomes apparent when you look at some of the points that they're making in the negative impacts that social media has had on society is it's just commodifying ego, right? It's commodifying insecurity. It's commodifying people's effort to idealize their self-image in a way that they think that they can get away with if there's this barrier there. I mean, that's what Instagram is. That's what a lot of Facebook has been. And it's just like, yeah, I mean, here's the technology that's going to capitalize on this. It didn't create this problem. But I think that it's kind and it's edifying to like make people aware of that instead of just kind of taking advantage of it. But you're right. I mean, that's why people are there and they're going to get some kind of psychic payoff from having that experience that you create for them. And I think you can distill that down to this lesson that a lot of us go to social media and they say, what do I want out of this? But if you're trying to build an audience and if you're trying to, go viral or gain exposure, or gain followers, the real question needs to be, what do other people want out of this? What do the people in my world want out of this? It's just as an aside, I thought when I started working on the Sales Gorilla, I thought I was baffled at the end of the show when Landon said, I love some of you, I like most of you, and there's a few of you I just can't stand. And I know the feelings. And I didn't get, I was like, why would somebody say that at the end of the show? I was just so oblivious. And then I realized it's like, that was like, it was the perfect statement about like something that we've talked about a lot in this show so far, which is like narrowing your market down to the best people, right? Like, few of you shouldn't be around here. Like, scram, you know? So then that was such a huge part of his message on the Sales Gorilla. So it took like 3 or 4 episodes to be like, oh, okay, I get why he says that. So in your training, we're not going to give this away in this podcast, but in the training you do, which is 2 parts, you talk about how you move on to like actually qualifying leads and bringing in business through this approach. But is there anything else, whether it came from the training or things you really still stand by, that are important to talk about as far as the approach to building engagement, tips or strategies?
Yeah. So, and we kind of touched on this and I want to kind of end it on this note. You just said something about these tools allow us to monetize people's egos or capitalize off of people's egos. That's what all marketing is.
Sure.
I'm not selling you an Adidas shirt so that you can advertise Adidas. I'm selling you an Adidas shirt because it helps you advertise your personality to the world. I'm not selling you a Harley. When you buy a Harley Davidson shirt, it's not because you want to advertise Harley Davidson. It's because you want to tell the world that you ride a Harley Davidson. You're a freedom, independent-minded person who's out on the highway seeking the road less traveled. When you buy Gucci, it's not because in Gucci, they got the Gucci print all over everything. It's not because you want to advertise Gucci. It's because you want to tell all the rest of the world, I've got enough money that I can spend it on Gucci.
Yep.
So
that reminds me, I need to point out to the video viewers that it looks like I'm just wearing the very basic John Belushi Animal House college t-shirt, but it's actually No Safe Spaces, Adam Carolla's movie. I was part of a podcast that was got a producer credit for this movie. So I realized, like, I'm looking at this, I'm like, you can't see the pacifier. So yeah, you're right. You're right. Damn, ego.
Yeah. So that's what we do. And that's one of the main things that I do on any type of advertising campaign. One of the main questions that I want to know the answer to is, what are these people's values? What are these, when these people, everybody virtue signals, it's not just the SJWs, the right wing people virtue signal, the non-political people virtue signal. We all, in the clothes that we wear, in the cars that we buy, in the jobs that we show up and work to, in the type of people that we get involved in relationships with. Most of these decisions that we make are all about signaling who we are to people that we really shouldn't even care what their opinion of us is, but we all do it. I wear this shirt because it tells you that I care about my fitness. I wear this shirt because it tells you that I care about freedom. I wear this shirt because it tells you that I care about Black lives. I wear this shirt because it tells you that I care about this. It's the exact same thing that social media capitalizes off of. And it's marketing at its core. Now, my suggestion is, there's the consumer mindset and there's the producer mindset. And this is something that I feel maybe not comfortable talking about, but it's how I honestly feel. There's us and there's them. And us, we're the producers, and them, they're the consumers. And what's good for the consumers is not good for the producers. And when I'm on Facebook, when I'm on social media, I'm there as a producer. I'm not there as a consumer. And as a producer, I don't have to worry about all of the things that the consumers are worried about. And as a producer, my goals are not the same as the consumers. And as a producer, the way that I approach my engagement on Facebook, on YouTube, on Twitter, on all these different social media platforms is different than the way that I would approach it as a consumer. So the truth of the matter is, yes, it's a double-edged sword. Yes, there's concerns. Yes, there's benefits. But when I approach these things, it's my own bias and it's my own preferences and my own goals that I'm trying to attain through the way that I interact with these things. But I approach these things as a producer and not so much as a consumer. And I think that that's the biggest difference in mindset of where my concerns about social media and marketing in general come from, is that I look at these things more from the producer point of view than from the consumer point of view.
Yeah, I think we could all, even as producers, we can identify with slipping into consumer mode occasionally with different things. Like, I've found myself going on Instagram to post and then I mindlessly scroll for a few minutes. But I'm not worried about myself, even though I haven't used it like with maximum effectiveness, as far as like, you know, like, oh, and maybe I am a consumer because I'm like, Facebook will keep a photo album for me of all the content that I make, right? Which is basically consuming the service in a certain way. And I can show it to people who are there, right? So while I am a producer outside of social media, maybe I don't fully have the producer mindset as far as like utilizing social media most effectively. But the shit that I see people doing on Facebook and reacting to and getting wandering into and getting lost in as far as like arguments, it concerns me very much, because that's what most people are doing. It's kind of like, you know, I was out in Colorado a couple of years ago and I was giving a talk to a bunch of people, and somebody asked me a question, you know, the typical, what would you do to fix the education system? I said, I don't care about that. You know, like, I'm, you know, here's my message, and if I can take you out of it and inspire you to do something else, that's what I do. And the guy was like, that's a cool story, but what about the 99%+ of people who are never going to, you know, 99.9% of people in this country who are never going to hear your message, you know, because they're still going to go to school. They're still going to be fed all this bullshit. They're going to graduate. They're going to vote. They're going to be manipulated by all these perception management systems. It's definitely something worth being concerned about. So I think, you know, when I am being alarmist about this stuff, it's the observations of what other people are doing. While I do recognize like a little bit of susceptibility to that consumer mindset, I don't feel like I'm the problem, and I'm not worried about myself. But we are at this point watching, when we just, if we return to the ego thing for a minute, and this is something that we've talked about a lot on my show, and I think even in this series, people now more than ever have wrapped their politics up with their identities, right? Where that is a part of ego. That is a part of who you are. That is like the Gucci sweatsuit or whatever. And people are getting meaning and identity from these things. And so now, in this very impersonal form of communication, where everybody just feels free to attack each other based on these things, all of these are being perceived kind of unconsciously, but very palpably as personal attacks, especially in a crisis where people are going, get with your tribe, find where safety is. The effect of that has been, you know, kind of culminating in, like, so far we're at January 6th, 2021, and we'll see where it goes. But the last year or so, and the last 5 years or so, have not really been very promising for this problem. So that's something to, I think, if you understand this, people in the audience, and you want to take on the responsibility of trying to point this out to other people. I was hoping some of these more mainstream documentaries would help raise awareness about this. I don't even think they're going to work. I think people on the left are going to watch The Social Dilemma and go, see, that's what's wrong with right-wing people. They don't even... Because my dad was telling me, you know, he has somebody in our extended family is like completely lost in CNN world. And he keeps saying to my dad, you know, he's real left. And he says, oh, we got to watch The Social Dilemma together. We got to watch The Social Dilemma together. Not understanding that it applies to him way more than it would apply to my 70-year-old father, who barely even uses social media. But he thinks it's a way to blame, you know, the whole Trump presidency on technology, you know, or something other than looking in the mirror. As far as your own politics or behavior is concerned.
Bringing it back to what the story you were talking about in Colorado, and this is something that as a libertarian, or as an anarchist, because I walk the line in between the two. A lot of people tell me, well, what's your solution to all of this? So I'm, you know, what kind of perfect government would you set up if you were in charge of creating a government? I feel you. I feel like it's this though. People are going to people. And most of them are going to suck. Most people are going to go through public school and then higher education, and they're never going to think twice about it. They're never going to reflect on what it did to them, the programs that it installed in their behavior and their thinking. Most people are not going to be your target market, but some people are going to have something that goes off, and they're going to start looking, and they're going to start trying to figure out what a solution is. They're going to start trying to figure out what a better way for their own children might be. And then you're going to be there. And it's not your job to tell people, hey, this is how school should be. It's your job to say to the people that say, hey, I'm not happy with this. Can you help me find a better way? And for me, that's kind of how I feel about social media and using it to market. Yes, I share a lot of the same concerns. Yes, I see tribalism and division and echo chambers being a problem that lead to bigger problems, that lead to some of the situations that we're in socially right now. But it's not my job to go out and tell everybody, hey, this is the problem with social media. It's my job to find the people that recognize social media can be used differently than the way 99% of people are using it. And it's my job to help those people. So just like for you, I don't think it's your job to go out and change the education system. It's to find the people who recognize the problem with the education system and want something better. And then you provide them solutions for something better. My role is not to change social media and all of the problems that we've talked about with it today. My role is to find the people that want to use social media for something better and show them paths to a better use of social media. And I think that that's my main takeaway from this conversation.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And it really speaks well to the serenity that you can get from understanding and operating in your sphere of control. We talk a lot about the designs that these evil groups have on the world, the World Economic Forum and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderberg Group.
I was going to say, and the shape-shifting reptiles, don't forget them.
Right. I mean, they came all the way here from another galaxy, so they're committed, right? So all of these nefarious groups operating, we talk about the designs, you know, like Fabian socialism. That was actually something that we covered on our In Pursuit of Utopia series recently, me and Danny McCarthy and Kevin Cole. But we have those designs too. You know, if you take libertarianism back 10 years ago and the Ron Paul revolution and the things we thought could happen and, you know, cryptocurrency and all the different ways that freedom could develop and, you know, being part of the Free State Project, you know, unfortunately, it's sad, but we've watched most of the world just go, okay, bye, dickheads. We're not interested. I forget where I talked about it recently in some podcast where, you know, being really inspired by Stefan Molyneux back in the day who said, you know, we're the heroes who are saving the world. That was a little grandiose, right? And he, a smart guy, in touch with reality, was able to adjust that message to save yourself, achieve a maximum amount of freedom in an unfree world, and help people where you can. But, like, get a grip on what you can actually do. And it sucks to say that, and I, you know, I maintain hope. I maintain optimism. My number one point of encouragement, we talked about this just the other day, is just to push as hard right now, as hard and fast forward in a way that is manageable with the things that are important to us, with the changes that we can make in the places that we can make them. So I really appreciate you saying that at the end of the show. I think that's always such an important message. It can't be reiterated enough.
Yeah. And sometimes I forget that we're in a mastermind together when we're doing these calls. But yeah, a lot of these conversations that we have on these calls have maybe roots in conversations that we have outside of them.
Yeah, it's funny because like there was some doom and gloom expressed in the call and a bunch of us were like, things are going to be great. and then there's today. And yeah, like I don't want to back away from that message. Like I'm going to be fine until the day that I'm not. And those are the days that I get, right? But I'm going to act as if until that day. So yeah, today is a turning point. We'll see what tomorrow looks like. But it affects, you know, my plan for tomorrow is already made and what happened today affects it very little. So kind of felt like maybe our optimism was a little overinflated on Monday, but we'll see, you know, I'm going to maintain it anyway. Is there anybody watching us live that wants to ask anything? I do have to go really soon and you probably do too, but I'd be happy to take a question.
I don't have access to the live feed right now because I can't open it up without it interfering with the audio of the recording.
Then no. So that's perfect. That's a nice and tidy hour and a half.
Let's use the last segment of the show to plug our respective projects.
Yes, you first, please.
Okay, so we talked a lot about social media and we teased a little bit about how I use social media to get sales. It's actually one of the many marketing, sales and marketing trainings that I offer to a private group that I have called the FMS Mastermind. And Brett, you're involved with that. You get access to all the stuff that's behind the scenes. There's trainings from not just myself. Landon Porter's got a couple trainings on there from the Sales Gorilla. There's a training from Ben Settle, who's an amazing email marketer. There's a training from David Garfinkel, who's like the world's greatest copywriting coach. There's a training on copywriting from Joe Schrieffer, who's one of the most successful copywriters in the world. So there's a lot of sales and marketing training, exclusive trainings there. And one of them, my favorite one, is the social media shitposting for fun and profit. That's the one that a lot of people have given me really positive response to because it takes sales and marketing and it applies it to how I operate social media. And it's where most of my money comes from, is from social media. So if people want to check that out, you can find out more at FMS, like Family Mastery Secrecy, mastermind.com, FMSmastermind.com. And Brett, for my audience, if they want to check out more of your work, where can they go?
Well, I say just find us on whatever podcatcher you use, School Sucks. Jump on the RSS feed just by going to schoolsucksproject.com. If you do not listen to what we do, just, you know, let's start building a relationship. Start listening to the podcast. Give it 3 episodes or listen to all the episodes Nathan and I have done together over the last couple months under this Emotional Manipulators for Hire banner. I'm like really happy with every show in that series. But, you know, we're approaching 700 episodes and it's a lot of like similar themes and explorations. And, you know, one of my the threads that runs through my work is this idea of the currents that people are in that they don't know they're in. And it kind of like speaks to, you know, say what your audience wants to say to their audience. I think we've done a really good job of providing people who listen to the show insights that they can share to educate other people, which is really, really important that this message can spread and help as many people as possible. Good heavens. But we also built a product last year that I mentioned earlier in this conversation under this University banner. And people can go to sspuniversity.com/ideas into action, which was a summit that we created, which was basically how to acquire, assimilate, and present in a persuasive way information. So I brought together a bunch of like well-respected authors and media creators, Kevin Geary, who your audience is certainly familiar with, Michael Malis, Tom Woods, Richard Grove, Steve Patterson, Jay Dyer, and many others, presentations on these three aspects of information acquisition, assimilation, like how to make meaning out of these things, and then how to present these things most persuasively. We run weekly discussion groups still, so there's a lot of community around that. And there's a whole bunch of Q&As. Scott Hambrick from Online Great Books, Michael Malis did one. I do a whole bunch of them. And I talk to these people, this group every week. And sometimes I have some of the presenters back. So that's SSPUniversity, just spell it university.com/ideas into action.
Awesome. Brett, I always have fun doing these. And just wanted to say thank you for entertaining this idea and putting it together.
Thank you so much. I love this conversation.
Are you ready for it? Ready for it? 'Cause I'm going for it, going for it. Can you take it, take it? 'Cause I'm going for it. Feeling happy, don't pay no mind. Tell yourself that you're one of a kind. You're so fancy, you sweating now. Run this shit, set the record, child. Feeling happy, don't pay no mind. Tell yourself that you're one of a kind. You're so fancy, you sweating now. Keep running, child. I got the gold, I think I'm gonna win. Race in the morning, damn.
Get to moving.
I got the gold, I think I'm gonna win. Race in the morning, damn.
Get to moving, finish line.